Bourbon and Brown Town is an affiliate podcast of Soapbox Production and Organizing that pairs critical analyses of media, culture, politics, and everyday happenings with the tastiest of spirits. With the occasional help of Chicago's most talented and creative artists, activists, filmmakers, academics, and social entrepreneurs, Brown Town unpacks current events, social issues, and gives personal insight into various topics.
Soapbox is a film and social activism nonprofit that specializes in multimedia curation of creative projects centered around education, entertainment, and structural social change for a more equitable and creative world. So for this episode, sit back, sip something good, and enjoy. And now it's a winner.
So hello everyone, I want to welcome everyone to another installment of Bourbon and Brown Town. I am your host, David of Brown Town, as always with my boy Colin. Colin, my dude, how you doing today?
I'm doing all right. Yeah. Been a little tense, a little frustrated today, but things are looking up. I had some salmon earlier that I made. It was fucking delicious. So that is one of the highlights, one of the couple highlights of the day. So I'll admit that, but I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm doing well, you know. Been a very interesting weekend. It's been fucking crazy, but you know, we don't need to go too much in depth. It's been
fun. I
don't
see you as much anymore. Like, I feel
it's
like
it's fantastic. I mean, I still feel like I see you all. No.
Let me rephrase. Fired.
I see you all.
Shots
the time. I feel
fired.
Like I see you, man. Like, let me just put it this way, okay? The person who texts me the most will probably be Colin, or tied with like my mom and Colin. I don't know. We'll figure that out.
So I beat your mom. Got it.
But you're right. We don't see each other as much. Maybe like once, twice a week, depending on where we're at. But I think it's fun. I think it's good. Because we're both busy. We're both doing shit.
This is true.
And we're out here bringing you guys another episode of Bourbon Brown Town. And we're joined by two very special guests, who is very interesting how the relationship kind of came to build. And so we'll kind of jump a little bit more. But I will go ahead and introduce our first guest. She is Tia Haywood. She's the managing attorney and solo practitioner of Haywood Monte Law Offices of Counseling with Schindler Pryor Law Offices. Tia graduated from Case Western Reserve University School of Law, and then Comillas Pontifica Universidad, Masters of Law, and then Howard University undergraduate. She is a lead attorney volunteering with Centros Sin Fronteras, as well as Latino Familia Unidos. Follow them on Facebook if y'all don't. And then she's also volunteered with First Defense Legal Aid, Chicago Community Bond Fund, National Lawyers Guild, Mass Defense Committee, Lawyers Committee for Better Housing, the Legal Assistance Foundation, Chicago Volunteer Legal Services, Expungent Clinics, and Know Your Right Presentations. God damn.
So many things.
What do you do when you're not? Never mind. Where is your free time? That's what I want to know.
I have no free time. I work 7 days a week. This is my free time. Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. Oh, thank you very much for being here with us. Colin, do you want to introduce
yourself? Yeah, we also have Jesus Vargas, 21-year-old paralegal at Haywood Monte Law Offices. Jesus started working there when he was 20. He received a paralegal certificate at DePaul University in 2016. Shout out Blue Demons. Grew up on the northwest side known as Belmont and Cragen area. And volunteer with Also and Ceasefire. Hey Zeus, what's good?
Oh, what's good? Thank you for the invite. Thank you for the invite. Really happy to be here. Thank you for waiting for us. And well, Tia definitely made some time because she's really busy. Really busy.
Yeah, she's on it all the time. It's crazy. So I kind of just want to just like jump straight into it. Like how'd you get to be doing so much? Let's just start there.
And what do you guys do kind of like daily? Like what is your relationship?
So we met at the Westside Justice Center. If you guys don't know about it, it is a co-op located on the corner of California and Harrison. You should stop by. It used to be an old church, I heard. So they did some renovations. And Helen Schiller, who used to be she was an alderman. Do you remember the area? She was the alderman.
Uptown.
She was an uptown alderman. She purchased the building along with her son, Brendan Schiller, and they started the Schiller Pryor Law Offices, and they had a dream to create a nonprofit. And from that nonprofit, we get the Westside Justice Center. That was their dream. And they wanted it to be a place for community, people in the community could come and access. If you don't know, the West Side is pretty, has a pretty significant homeless population, as well as issues with drugs and law enforcement. There's a lot of, you know, instances of police brutality. We see it constantly on a daily basis. So with the West Side Justice Center, it's kind of like a beacon for the community that hopefully it can be reformed. We're not trying to actually take over, because hopefully we get to improve the neighborhood and not push the residents out, but not gentrify it. But for the most part, the local community members are allowed to come in, get free consultations. And a lot of the attorneys who work in that building, my firm is also based out of that building. We give volunteer with the West Side Justice Center to give free consultations. So it's been a blessing, I believe.
And so down.
And the community, yeah.
Yeah, and so, and how long have you been there?
So I, sure. I started my firm in 2016, actually. Mm-hmm. I was working more so with Of Counsel with Schiller Prayer, because I don't know if that year was particularly special or special for me, but there seemed to be a lot of civil rights cases coming through the door, lots of instances of police brutality, people who had been, who felt like they had been harassed or stopped by the police unnecessarily, unjustifiably placed into criminal proceedings and had criminal cases that they had won. So that year, I worked with Schiller Prayer as of counsel, and they started teaching me basically about like civil rights law and how to litigate cases of that nature. And from that, I wanted to provide resources to community members, more accessible legal resources. So I started basically offering like payment plans and different options of that nature for, you know, regular people to be able to afford legal services.
And then you guys both met at the West Side Justice Center, am I correct?
Correct.
Sweet. And then so how did you get exposed to that?
Through the community. Actually, I started working, working with this nonprofit organization called the ALSO. It's a Alliance of Local Service Organization. Mm-hmm. So it was actually in Humboldt Park. They actually help high-risk individuals, high-risk students. Really, they try to target the students that are in high school around the high school in Clemente. And pretty much they mentor couple of the youth. They mentor the youth for the Humboldt Park community, and they bring in these high school students that want a opportunity to grow. Really, they have a program called 10-10-10, and it's for $10 an hour, 10 weeks, and it's 10 hours a week. So what they do is with the time that they have with these individuals, they'll teach them about how to interact with police if they ever get pulled over, because it happens a lot that young people they get harassed around the neighborhood for being around the neighborhood. Well, living there really is what it is. So they actually heard of the West Side Justice Center. They actually work with the West Side Justice Center. I'm not too sure how or.
Yeah, where that connection fits. Right.
Yeah. And so really, I got the opportunity to intern at the Schiller Prayer Law Offices. The really blessing I really got from it was the experience, because I never really thought I would ever be at a firm, working with attorneys that are actually involved a lot in the community and have really high risk, high profile cases. And really, they actually inspired the community. They inspired me once I started to get to know the resources there at the West Side Justice Center. It's a lot. They got the First Defense Legal Aid, the Chicago Community Bond Fund. The West Side Justice Center is great for, it's a great resource for the community, really, because they do come with housing problems and, you know, just not problems, but, you know, there's legal issues that they, one can't afford, you know, at times, and they try to find a place that they could go and see what they could do about their legal case. So through this internship, I actually got to meet Tia, and she actually offered me a job position last year in 2008, to be her paralegal. And it's been great. Our relationship is wonderful. I love every second of it. Working with her, I don't know if you guys ever heard of the phrase. It's not where you work, it's who you work with. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful phrase. So I thankfully get to live by that phrase.
You kind of have to say that because she's like in the room right
now. No,
like, actually, my job is fantastic. It's amazing.
Voice every other day.
I'm kind of curious because like Dave and I have been to the Westside Justice Center a couple times.
I was there for the party. It was banging. For the election party. Right, it was cool, but we'll continue.
I'm curious, how rare is a space/co-op like that? Like, do you know of other places like the Westside Justice Center in other cities or in Chicago or places that are very much rooted in the community, rooted in helping everyday people, but also have the legal resources to actually do that in a fashion that's not everyone has access to?
For me, not really. And that was the special thing about it. There are these other organizations such as maybe like the Woodlawn organization, sure, different organizations and not-for-profits, but I've never seen them have co-op space.
Yeah.
Like if it's the organization and it's the organization space, it's usually just the organization, sure, and its space. I haven't seen, for example, like the Westside Justice Center, I haven't seen anything like that where they share space with other organizations. So there's actually several not-for-profits in one building. If there is, I just haven't seen it. So
they got to shout out to us so we can know who they are. What do you do?
Exactly. Yeah. But I would like to shout out at least the Westside Justice Center, because the fact that it shares space, not just it being its own not-for-profit, but with other not-for-profits. Like he mentioned, the Chicago Community Bond Fund is there. The First Defense Legal Aid is there. Those are different organizations within one place. It's almost like a one-stop shop. All we would need is the Cabrini Green Legal Aid or some type of expungement.
Cabrini Green, where y'all at?
They're going to be emailing the Westside Justice Center.
Yeah. All we need is to add them, and then we'd have it all, basically.
No. I don't want to back up too much, but David, how did we get connected with these wonderful folks in the first place?
And so it's interesting because I'm from the west side of Chicago, and I didn't know that this space existed, like, a year and a half ago. Like, I knew that these things exist, like, you know, legal aid for people who don't necessarily have it. Because I know, like, my parents have had to use some of these type of resources, not necessarily the Westside Justice Center. But it's like, you know, you got money to pay for an actual attorney. You got to go to court, blah, blah, blah. You find somebody to help you out, kind of similar to that. So as you guys are familiar with the Dump Matt Coughlin campaign that took place, that was a collaboration with multiple organizations. And so we had the opportunity to sit down with two of the gentlemen who were falsely incarcerated for plus 20 years and kind of like hang out with them, get their story, and then really be able to mold something out of that in a two and a half minute video, which I think was super cool. And then seeing all the resources there, like I was aware that I was aware of the Chicago Community Bond Fund. I wasn't aware that like that was a specific space. Same with the First Defense. And so, like, the only thing I was aware of was the Black Panther Memorial that they have, or, like, room stuff that they've accumulated, which is super cool, right? Like, especially, like, being from the West, I'd be like, man, I know my city, you know what I'm saying? Like, I know. And then I come into this space, and like, this has been here the whole time? Right. So that was, it was kind of nice, right? But it's like, as you guys talk about, like, sometimes, like, we need to be exposed to that. And I think once I was able to be in that space and kind of talk to more people, I was like, there was a gentleman there who from the defense, a First Defense, who like gave me a stack of business cards. He's like, people don't know we're here. Just tell people we're here. I'm like, bro, I'm giving this to everybody I can think of. It's like, you need one. And then that's how it is, right? At the end of the day is the word of mouth. But I think places like the Westside Justice Center are like very, very valuable. And so it was really cool to see it from that perspective and then have help from within the organization, such as Ben, Christina, who was helping us out for the marketing of it all. So shout out to both of them, because that's exactly how we got connected with Tia. So shout out to Christina for making this happen.
Speaking of that project and just like that campaign, really more so the Dumb Matt Coughlin, I know Tia, you kind of speak a little bit to like voting, getting politically engaged. I'm curious like how you came to this work and how you see like, I don't necessarily say liberation, but just how do you see like your idea of making the world like a better place through this work, this legal work? Because obviously there's multiple avenues to do that, right? There's like different avenues to create nonprofits or like be an activist in the streets. And obviously you're doing this through like a legal system that is, you know, oftentimes criticized as being problematic. But you're doing this work and you have the same worldviews. Like, how do you navigate those waters as far as like doing this work for like a really broader, it might be like radical social good, but also going through this process that is very specific and very stringent?
So how I navigate is I actually do so in a out of the box type of way. So I like to come at a problem, a legal problem, from a traditional mindset. How would things traditionally fit within the scope of how a case is litigated? So, you know, cases are typically litigated. You'll file a complaint. You'll make a complaint in front of the judge and you'll go from there, or you're arrested and criminal proceedings are initiated against you. And then you start to basically litigate a case from there. So I think of the traditional way in which a case is litigated and how what the normal practice is, because what you find for law is that while there are laws that you can use sometimes for your benefit, they might be applied differently in different courts in front of different judges. Hence, going back to the JPAC campaign, shout out to JPAC. They did a tremendous job, and I'm thankful to be a part of that. But when you, the legal community was pretty, pretty big part, played a big part in that campaign. Why? Because for years, Cook County voters would just vote these judges for retention. Mm-hmm. They just relied upon this other Democratic organization that says, hey, these judges are okay, so let's just vote them back in. They had no one to tell them the track record of these judges. But who gives you the track record of these judges? The attorneys. When we go into the courts, we can tell you which judges are given harsher sentences. We can tell you which judges are denying bond and bail. We can tell you which judges, because it's local practice. It's me walking into a court on a day-to-day basis, talking with this judge, interacting with this judge, and sometimes sitting there watching the judge waiting for my case and seeing how they talk to other people, other defendants. I can tell you all judges have gotten better since that campaign.
Yeah. On their toes. On their toes.
They have all been
booty holes tight.
Very relay. So that was the people and the legal community working together to make a change.
Yeah.
So that was us thinking outside of the box, because it hadn't been done in so long. Who are we to challenge that? A bunch of, like, you know, wayward lawyers. They could have called us bitter, a bunch of bitter old criminal defense attorneys. Well, hey, I'm not so old. I don't think so. But but the younger and the younger attorneys and more elderly attorneys and more experienced attorneys banding together to say, hey, we want to create a new, better courtroom, new practice guidelines for everyone. We want things to get better for everyone. And they enacted that. The community went out and canvassed. Regular people with no titles or no had no formal training or experience in the legal community got out, hit the ground pavement with their marched with their feet and went to different doors and knocked on people's doors. Hey, did you know this judge? You know, wrongfully was a state's attorney at the time and resulted in several members of the community being wrongfully convicted. Did you know this judge, you know, he gives harsher sentences for certain demographics? Did you know, just telling people about what was going on. Right. And when people were able to hear that, then they were able to band together and demand from that organization, the one who used to tell the people which judges were okay, tell that organization that judge was not okay. And then that judge was kicked off. So I think that's the reason why I do what I do. Because you can save, you end up saving multiple lives, because it's not a big thing. That was a big thing. Usually it's the little small things that add up to something big. And you just take it step by step, day by day, and you get a victory.
Yeah. Yes. Ooh,
it's so good listening to it from like your perspective, right? Because like, we build media to produce change, right? That's the whole thing. And so, like, when I came about, when this project got on our plates, I thought it was really exciting. I thought I didn't really know what to expect, but I knew that we were going to be able to do some shit. And then, like, hanging out with Jose and Armando, and like seeing the way in which they were like able to open up, and that basically, like, we couldn't have created anything we created without their input. because of the fact they were so open and so willing to share their stories, because there's also like, what, 90 minutes of footage that we just have that like are testaments to things that you guys see on the other side, right? That like I have no experience over. And so, but it's kind of nice to hear that on both sides. Because when we found out that Matt was no longer reelected, we're like, yeah, fuck it. Like, this is cool for Soapbox, right? Like, we were able to be a part of this larger thing. But then on the other side, it's like, yeah, no, like, we were doing this, like, on a regular basis, trying to fuck all these people sideways. So it's like, and so we're like, yo, we're
one way to put it, sure.
No, but I mean, I think it's cool. And I think it's really great to be able to hear from both perspectives, you know?
I just need to say that, too, because, like, I remember talking to Ben and some other folks with the campaign. It was like, yeah, like, Matt Coughlin is, like, toxic, like super problematic for a lot of reasons, right? But like, he's one of like many who are like that. But with campaigns, it has to be like, you have to put your time, energy, and capacity into like something that's very targeted. So you have to like, you had to look at after this one person, like next cycle, another person, next cycle, maybe someone else, which is like fine. But obviously, there's like multiple folks who should be voted out. But you can only do so much with like messaging and narrative and all that, which is like feels kind of shitty because it's like, no, I want to get rid of everyone who's bad, bring everyone good in. But it's like you have to manage your expectations, right? And manage like your workload and stuff too. And then like even broader than that, I think one of the things I kind of wanted to get at, like this episode is very much about like law and legal practices for like liberation. So it's like, how do we get to this aspirational ideal, like goal of like liberation or of like true getting rid of all the systems of oppression we always talk about? But doing it, like you said, very like incremental reformist kind of steps to get there. And I think one of the good things with making this project and working on with this campaign with so many folks, as far as like talking about Matt Coughlin's problematic history, but then using that to explain how the whole system in general is like rooted in some things that are not good and like systemically are unfair, we were able, I think, other examples of this. Well, like No Cop Academy, other things, mm-hmm. we're able to use like an example to talk about a broader macro level issue.
Yeah,
and I'm curious with like with your background and hey, Sue, especially you saying you're from an activist family and stuff, being part of these like more radical traditions and working in this very streamlined capacity, how you kind of go back and forth between those two worlds as far as like the legal world and like probably more bureaucratic, and then like an activist world and like being on the streets and working for justice reform and immigration reform and all that good stuff. Does that make any sense? I said a lot of words.
No, yeah.
I was like thinking and talking.
That's usually like, the case. It's great though. The case. Yeah.
Yeah. I believe, that, well, one, you know, to actually fund a campaign, I mean, that's a different, that's a different structure. But as far as, you know, getting the right people to march down the street and, you know, knowing that there could be a repercussion to your action, knowing that you have a certain right that you're marching for, and then somebody on the outside is looking at you like, oh, well, that's what he thinks. But like, the way I feel is pretty much is how it's going to stay. And pretty much it's really hard to, you know, just change the way how people think. So some people are never going to think like you. So the fact that people go out and really put their time and energy to these sorts of projects, I feel like it's a necessity, definitely, because nobody really looks into it. A lot of people, they just, live every day, right, check by check, and just really focus on their day of life. Mm-hmm. Some people don't have the time or the energy to, look what's going on, look at how the world is and what's going on outside of
Or they also don't want to, right? That's the point of that. I feel that, like, with background, but I'm sorry for cutting you off.
No, it's fine. No, yeah, because that's pretty much where I was ending at. It's just the fact that, people still march and still, are willing to call out certain judges and really just try to get them off bench, because mm-hmm. everybody's life, whether you pay attention to it or not, that's the knockoff, that you are affected by it. Mm-hmm. So many.
Is it hard to get that across to some folks?
That's a tough part because, like I said, we all have a different life. So my parents, they were marching for immigration rights, and a lot of people won't to this day believe that America was technically like nationalized like that. Like that's how people came about. They came from different places and really they started creating a structure to how people should one live, and really a lot of people didn't want to live the way they were wanted to. So like when we're talking about history and the way you know it was formed, a lot of marches were actually done because somebody had to do it. So for people to really view the way you're viewing it is always going to be the tough part. It's hard to basically persuade people that you know these people have some right. Like so immigrants, they feel like they don't have any rights, right? But you know you have certain companies that are knowing that they did not come in with certain paperwork. So say some people work without you know socials, some people work without work permits, yeah. You know, and it's just like to them, you know, they'll look over it when they're making money. But, you know, mm-hmm. if they're not, because you could sit here and say, we could sit here and say, you know, oh, it's because they're criminals, they don't deserve no rights, or they're here illegally and so on and so forth. You know, we could all throw, you know, a narrative, but really, really it's just like, in my eyes, I feel like, laws are great. They're a great structure, and they're really great because they're meant for the environment to feel safe. But sometimes you just cannot control. You know, you can't control crime. So and it's hard. And then at that, how can you control somebody coming from a different country over here? Mm-hmm. So it's always going to be like a back and forth, but. My whole idea is that a lot of immigrants, one, you know, they work hard to provide mm-hmm. from the people I've been around with. They really work hard for what they get. You know, they do disobey the law for coming here illegally or being here illegally. But outside of that, they don't have no criminal background. It's just like a hearsay. Like that's what they assume when a person comes from. A place that you know the economy isn't well and really they just really want to like work and live yeah. a life that you know they just feel like they deserve and especially you know with the criminal justice system that is pretty much it's like basically go off the way somebody looks the majority of the time they view you and they try to belittle you mm-hmm. throw words at you that you don't even understand and mm-hmm. and at that you got other people coming in from a different country don't even speak the same language and, mm-hmm. and it's really like so they have them sign you know some of these immigrants they come on here unrepresented and they get grabbed so they're not represented by an attorney so they just sign off knowing that they possibly have a chance to fight and stay. Mm-hmm. Some people just don't know. So I feel like as far as trying to persuade somebody or you know to actually care, I think that's the hard part. But until the work is done and there's progress that gets shown, I guess that's when people really like, oh, okay, this is really mm-hmm. working, and we should really be involved more because the community isn't really involved in these projects as much as they should be.
Are your parents or were your parents like did they come into the country illegally or are you like
yeah second? they did cool. They actually came here illegally. My father was actually sponsored by his company that has been working there for like 32 years, Transomatic. Yeah. So these great people actually helped my dad fix his papers and whatnot, and now they're actually here residents.
Yeah.
And everything's was worth the fight. It was worth the fight, definitely. Yeah, going to citizens, actually.
You're yep. going to citizens? Yeah, cool. Because, like, both my folks are from Malefe, and so my mom has citizenship, my dad has residency. So, it's, like, it's really interesting, because, like, but, like, my parents growing up, like, they weren't marching for immigration rights. They didn't...
Oh, they were scared.
It's I think my parents, and I think this is something that's really interesting, and, like, I don't want to go too off topic, but, like, when we're trying to give... information, so to speak, to communities and like help them get engaged into the what's happening around, right? It's like I admire the fact that like your age and like the type of work that you're throwing yourself into, because you don't got to be doing that.
Right.
You're
right.
The one who decided to do it. And so like I like that, to me it's extremely inspiring, right? And not only that, but you're able to go home and you're able to go to your mom's house or your pop's house or wherever it's at, and it's like you go back with the knowledge that you accumulated during the day. And you're like, pop's like, guess what I just heard?
Right.
This shit.
Like, my dad loves that. He
Dad, where you at?
Yeah, like, we need to talk.
It's Dad, serious. Do you know what Trump is doing right now?
But yeah, he's changing the laws. You gotta understand, they're terminating TPS, but it's getting real.
But it's, and so my point in saying all of this though is like it's sometimes like ignorance can be a choice, right? But after that is like, how do we go about then breaking down some of the language that you're exposed to, right? You're saying like sometimes these police officers come at us with like $7 words, and like. Yes, or no, right? It's like, and it's confusing. But then, how can we go about like providing this information, providing these things? And I think that's one of the things that the Westside Justice Center does very successfully. And like, I know that they're like, I think they're bilingual, maybe trilingual, like to try to reach as many people as possible, right? And I think the thing with my mom, for example, is like. My mom, so I showed her the dumb Matt Coughlin video, and she's like watching it, and she's really attached to Jose's story. And she was like, well, why was he in jail for 23 years? And I'm like, because somebody thought that he did something, so they put him in, but he didn't do it. Like, look at his eyes, he looks so kind. And I was like, but that happened. She's like, well, that's wrong, he shouldn't have been in there. And I'm like, well, you could have helped make some shit happen. She's like, well, what am I supposed to do? I'm like, vote. And she's like, but what does that do?
I love you, mom.
I mean, like, so I'm saying, like, those are the conversations I have, but like you on the other hand, you know, like you're much more in the shit, so to speak,
if you will,
with terminology. Like, you know, my mom calls me from the police station, be like, "Mom, you should have called a lawyer. First, called a lawyer." She actually has a first defense legal card in her wallet, because I was like, "Mom, you need one of these just in case you're." She's not gonna go to jail. She's fine.
No, just in case. It's always
no. I mean, but it's how we go about providing this information to different communities.
Right.
I think
it's
really cool.
Yeah.
Also, how we digest it as individuals, right? Like your community based on where it's at, and it's like, you know, it's a progress. Nothing happens from one day to the next. And I think it's.
I would just like to add that it's also about exposure, because. To be honest, when I first got interested in law, I was interested in my community. My community, I felt, had issues with criminal defense and criminal justice reform. So I started off being interested in law for that area, because that's where I felt the need was. But as I got exposure to other communities, I studied different languages. I studied different cultures. I'm a lover of languages, a lover of cultures. I love studying. I love traveling. And, you know, I studied and just kept studying, just kept reading, just kept researching. And then I just started meeting people and talking to people and realizing that, well, you know, like, this goes beyond your community. Like, you're not the only ones that need criminal justice reform. Because as we see nowadays, that all of that is starting to meld together. We talk about criminal justice reform, but we can acknowledge now that, you know, like, Latino communities and, you know, maybe Polish communities, other communities are also affected by this. They just go to different courts, so we might not see them. But since I've been traveling to all the courts, I see all different types of people. So I know that it's not just the issue for, like, well, I'm African-American, so for the Black community, it's not just an issue for the Black community. It's not just an issue for a Latino community. It's an issue for, you know, broadly, it affects everyone, because it could be you at any moment, and they can say, oh, I suspect you've been drinking, and take away your car and take away your license and take away your job and throw you in jail. I mean, all these things happen in succession, and it's just kind of like a rolling block. Once it starts, it keeps going. And then next thing you know, if you're an immigrant in that situation, now you have immigration concerns. They could or could not call ICE. They could or could not, you know, call your embassy or do all kinds of unnecessary things that if somebody gets a particular animus towards you for whatever reason, it could just have a snowballing effect on your life. And now, I mean, it's not even just your life. It's who you live behind. You know, there's wives, there's children. And I've met in my legal practice families from all over the place. I have a husband from born over in, I recently met a couple. The husband is Mexican, the wife is Salvadorian, and the kid is American. So like in that situation, if they grab husband or wife, where do you send them? What happens to the kid? Like, it's just, it's, it has a snowballing effect. And then you start not only talking about family law, because that's the family law. Okay, who's going to take custody of the kid? Should they get grabbed? If they get grabbed, that's immigration law. And if they grabbed him because he was pulled over for suspected driving under the influence, that's criminal. So all these areas, and then if they beat him up in the process, that's civil rights. So all these areas are actually starting to become a circular circular issue for everybody involved. So yeah, more exposure to the community just kind of really opened my eyes that, you know, this is an issue bigger than me. So I, you know, I didn't I never formally took any classes, but I learned Spanish because I said, well, I need to be able to, it's also about communication. Like, I need to be able to communicate. I need to be able to, like, really figure out, you know, what's going on here. And then, I think, community-wise, I think we could also, like, we should also not just get out and march, but go to the courts. They're public places.
Yeah.
You're allowed there as the public, as a community. Go there and see what's going on. You get a day off or you get some time and you want to hear something interesting, you'll hear a lot of interesting things at your local court.
Yeah.
Court watch is something we really want to start highlighting now. Now that people are more active and awake, go to the courts. Hear how the judges talk.
Well, which courts? Let's see. Direct me. I know nothing. What court can I go to?
It would be
I got a Tuesday morning from 10 to 3.
I'm on the west side.
I'm on the west side.
Okay.
26 in California.
Yeah.
Okay. Where do you live?
He has said in previous episodes he will not go.
I'd rather not.
That's exactly where you need to go because that's where Judge Coughlin sat.
Past tense.
But there's other judges that are sitting.
They're next. Don't worry about it.
You need to see which ones they are so you can write the list and maybe you can actually start the campaign. And where do you live?
South Loop.
Yeah. So your court would be go to the Daily Center. You go to the Immigration Courthouse. Immigration Court is on 525 West Van Buren.
Have you guys seen criminals one day? Man, just imagine immigration, because they say immigrants are usually categorized either Mexican or Salvadorian, so on and so forth. But, you know, you have people actually coming from, Russia. You got people coming from
everywhere.
And it's just like you see all kinds of people. Like, seriously, it's very mind-blowing how they just portray it to be just certain. No, it's bigger than that.
I mean, the whole thing. I was like, go court watch. It's a public place you can always go to, right?
Yes.
And I feel like statistics.
And more eyes, I think it does something to the judges. It makes them so nervous.
Especially because then you're mobilized with folks, because they will expect,
oh, you're here for court. What's your name? That's the first thing I'm going to ask you. And I don't know, I'm here watching. You're going to be surprised. Yeah. Oh, okay.
It's important. That's what I've seen the past couple of years as far as just like being involved in activist circles and stuff, as far as not just court watching, but like go to the city council meeting. It's an open meeting to the public. Okay. Your older person probably won't show up because half of them fucking do.
Never.
But like go and like see what's on the table, see how they're budgeting things, see when the CPD comes in and tries to ask the city council for more money, then obviously fucking gets it.
Always.
And they always get it.
Where does it go?
But no, it's like, I think that's a super important point as far as these are all public things that we all essentially pay for, that we have access to.
Right.
And like, you're totally right. The optics of it matter, having folks mobilize in their matter, and especially therefore for a reason, you have like signs that say like "fuck ACOM" and things of that nature during city council meetings. Like that matters. That's something I slowly learned the past couple of years. As far as A is public, B we can mobilize and actually make a difference, and C you can kind of just see what's going on in your city and see where your money's going, see the decisions that are being made supposedly on your behalf, right?
Right. Right. But they're acting on your behalf.
There you go. That's the most important point.
Yeah. Not actually acting for your behalf. They're taking your vote and counting it where they believe in their hearts they want to put it, and that's where they want to put it in their hearts and not where your heart wants to put it.
Sure.
Exactly how it works. So, yeah, my biggest push would be go court watch. Just go to some court. Go to the nearest court if you don't know where it is. You can Google it. Cook County is huge. And if you live outside of Cook County, Joliet, go to Will County. There's other local counties around DuPage, right? McHenry, wherever. Yeah. But go to a court. Like, if you live out in, like, what is that, Elgin? Go to Rolling Meadows. Like, that's the farthest one. I didn't even know that was still Cook County until I had to go for a client. I was like, Jesus, are we still in Cook County?
Where
are we at? So
it's how long a drive?
I was like, oh, it's an hour and a half. So go court watchers, figure out what's your local court, and just go in there, sit and listen to the judges, you know, how they talk to the people, how they talk to the defendants, and you will learn a lot. And then you know when it comes time to vote and you're voting based on your area, like, okay, what judges are, did you see? Like, write their names down. You know, you can write down, like, what things stood out to you. The journalists use it all the time. It's like they're good pass. So when we get a high-profile case, but if you live on the west side, 26 in California is where you need to be, because we have much more work to do. And the judges are nice now, but for how long is that going to last? Right. They're waiting for us to go to sleep again, so then they can just fall back into old practice. It's old practice for a reason. It never goes away. They just reinvent it, just like the old laws on the books. We still haven't got rid of a lot of those old laws. So, you know, they have, as long as they still exist, they can just act like they don't know about them until then they know about them. And then all of a sudden they're like, well, this was on the books the whole time. You didn't know? Oh, too bad, because we're using it against you now. So we're starting to see a lot of, like, reused, rehashed old laws being used, old practices, old regulations, just different things that were just archaic being applied to today's contemporary society. And if we're not going to stand for it, we need to actually see when it's being used, how it's being used, and for what reason or what purpose it's being used. We need to know that. And who's using them? Mm-hmm. Who's doing this? So court watching would be, I think, the next step. It would be the best thing we could ever do. You have a free day, just go court watch, especially immigration court. You'll learn a lot. How similar those courts are to criminal courts, how similar, but they had none of the, like, hardly none of the protections, but they're so similar. For one, the person's detained. Person's in custody. They're in custody of a police or some type of authority. For two, these people have bond hearings or bail hearings or however you want to call them. And for three, this person, in the event that they lose their case, they get a punitive, possibly a life sentence. They get deported and they can go back to their country and get killed if the judge just doesn't believe their story that they're applying for some type of protection. Or, you know, they're sitting in jail waiting for a decision on their case, and that's punitive in and of itself. I mean, we've created this whole criminal justice reform to say that these people shouldn't be sitting in jail waiting for the resolution of a case. Well, right. The courts have said it's okay. So if that's not criminal, I don't know what is. But why don't they get the protections? They don't get the protection of Fifth Amendment, protection against self-incrimination. They don't get the attorneys. That the attorneys have to be, you know, they have to be provided an attorney. They have a right to an attorney. They don't have a right to an attorney. They have a right to sign that voluntary departure and they can leave this country as quick as possible. And that's what's been happening. So I think we need a lot more eyes all over these courts, all over every court. People should just be piling in just to let them know, like, we're here, we're listening, we're not going back to sleep.
That's the next project.
I mean, and that sounds, and like, I don't know, like a part of me is like, yo, that sounds great, but it's like, you work 7 days a week.
Yeah,
a lot of these fams out here working 7 days a week like that. Right. So like, we don't got time. I have time, but there are people in the communities that like don't have time, or like they get one day off. They don't want to be going to the courts and like listening to shit they don't understand.
And that's a knockoff. That's the future though.
But they don't have time until they had time, because you get grabbed and you got time. You get when somebody pull you over and say, "Oh, you suspected of a DUI." Now you got time once every month, because you will be in court every month, or there will be a warrant, and then you'll be sitting in Cook County Jail waiting for your time to get your day in court. So you will have time for that.
Are people understanding that? And if that judge you get, do you think with like the Cogman situation, with honestly being like Trump being in office, you kind of alluded to like people being like more active now. I think a lot of that's because of Trump. I think we can admit that. Do you think because of the saliency of activism, or just broader just resistance in whatever capacity, people are being more primed to make the time and to do these things? Do you think that's true? And if so, where are people putting their energies?
I think people...
Everyday folks, people who are previously unpoliticized, especially.
Me.
Sure, yeah. I think people, I mean, we have a whole bunch of movements going on, but I don't mean to co-opt the, what is it, the hashtag Me Too, but I think that is a pretty good, accurate reflection for it. Until it was Me Too, a lot of people are not, are unaffected. Right. Because like you just mentioned before, I'm working 7 days a week. You're working 7 days a week. I don't have time. But you don't have time until you have time. And next thing you know, you can't be working 7 days a week because you're sitting in jail. You're holding like that. Right. And now you have to go to court once a month and your job might not accept that. So my thing is, you don't have time. Make time. Act like your life depends on it, because it does. When this law gets passed and it's on the books, like, that's your life. It may not affect you now, but when it affects you now, it's gonna be a problem.
Hashtag Me Too.
So now, and then now you're going to need that mobilization, because oh my God, it's affecting my life. My life is falling apart. Where's everybody? This outrage, like your personal outrage of like this affront to my dignity, they're like just grabbing people up and just taking their licenses. And at first you can just say, oh, well, that's them. Well, you shouldn't be driving under the influence of alcohol until it's you. And you're like, well, wait a minute, I wasn't drinking. And they don't care. You're still getting put in jail. Your car is impounded. Right. Mm-hmm. You got to pay, you know, here in Chicago, they pay for everything. You got to pay for storage to get your car out, even though they took your car.
My brother left his car in there because he's like, the car's worth less than what they wanted. Less.
So now they just got a free car that they can sell. Right. So not only did they take the money from you. Then if you lose your case, you have to pay court fees, fines, and costs. Yeah. I mean, it's just a snowball. You got to pay an attorney. You got to pay to get your license back. You got to pay your
car fees.
You got to pay your car fees. You got to get special insurance and court fees, administrative costs. You got to pay for these classes you don't even want to go to. So now all of a sudden, what happened to your 7 day a week time that you didn't have?
Right.
Because now you got to make time.
No, but for real, like that's actually the response I wanted.
I was fucking the entire time. No, it's real. Like there's a quote by a Jewish poet. I don't want to say his last name, but people will put in the episode notes. But his poem goes, first they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me. Right? And like how real is that? How much is that like evidence, like what you're saying? And now I called him Jewish, now he says came the Jews, think I didn't speak out, so he probably wasn't Jewish. But point being, we get that, right? And it's like I hear this a lot, and I think especially post Trump folks are a lot like, oh, like now I'm being attacked and I want to speak out, which is like good. You want to get those folks to the table, right? But it's like how you're like, we've been fighting for this shit for a minute, how do you do? But you still need that mobilization, right?
Yeah.
But I think there's some issue with like this empathy factor, or sympathy factor, I'm sorry. But it's like, it has to affect you in order for you to be mad about it. And that's really human, right? Like, I get that. But to an extent, it's like, do I have to be a woman to know that rape is wrong? Like, right? Or do I need to be a woman to know that, like, talking about women as objects or talking about things that are problematic is messed up? And is there a way that you to feel implicated and know how you benefit from a system, but also fight against it at the same time? So I don't know. But the empathy thing is always interesting to me because I feel like there's, you can still like fight against something even though you benefit from it, or if it may not affect you yet because it's just like, because it's just wrong. But it's hard to get there.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. It starts with yourself. You know, that's how change happens. Somebody got to do it. Somebody brave enough, go out there, make some time.
But I think it's a very important thing to continue to reiterate that, like, you know, it's like just because it's not happening to you, but it's also interesting because like, okay, sure, it's not happening to me, but then I can be on the mindset and, you know, I'm hearing certain people in my head like, but that's not going to happen to me.
Right. Right.
It's like, oh no, that's that I'm never going to fall in that. Or like, nah, like I don't got those problems to worry about. It's like, you know, it's.
Hey, I was one of the, people that, that was like, oh, that's not gonna happen to me. That's not gonna happen to me. You know, I'm a citizen. You know, I shouldn't have any kind of problem.
I wish I was. I was just like, you know, I don't care.
You know, how I got my paralegal certificate was actually I signed a voucher and whatnot. So I'm actually doing my selective services, and I got a voucher through that, and I was able to go to school, DePaul. So me thinking, you know, man, I'll give my life up for this country, you know, because, you know, anything that happens, you know, you're a citizen here, and you know, any problems that the United States. So now we're talking country-wise, right? Mm-hmm. Any problem that, you know, country has, you know, you're going to be frontline. So me being, you know, I don't want to say naive, because, you know, I just never thought it would happen to me. I'd be a victim of police brutality. So, like, being exposed to now we're talking about you hear, but actually when you live that and you experience that, how many people do you know, either one, are telling the story, right? Because, you know, you find that, like, very rare. And I say that because the indictment on the officer, Jason, with Laquan McDaniels. So it's a touchy subject because, you know, although I did not get shot, I did get choked and I did get hit. And the fact that, you know, you went from, man, I will give it my all to this country, to something like, man, it's questionable. Like, now you question the loyalty. So I was very loyal to everything I was doing, you know. But now it's like it makes you question so much what's going around. So when people talk about, oh, they don't have time, or you know, you even saying or thinking that, like, man, you know, it's never going to happen to me. And then, you know, you're now out there marching with people that, you know, with Black Lives Matter and other people that you know, they've been a victim, or they've just been treated unfair based on their race or color. It's just really that's I feel like that's about the lowest we could go on humanity.
Well, I mean, and we see that specifically, like, you know, you bring up the Jason Van Dyke trial, which I think, you know, the way it happened, the way it was concealed, the way the trials took over, the way media decided to report it, and then the outcome, right? Kind of, I don't know. It was one of the only trials that, like, I can say for myself that, like, I paid close attention to, and even then it wasn't, like, that close. It was just like I made sure to see what was going on. I remember we were at Whole Foods when the verdict was coming out, and we're just like, what?
I mean, like, don't know, Dave. What was the verdict of the Jason Van Dyke trial?
So he was found guilty.
Right? How many counts?
16?
12? Oh, 16. Got
16.
It.
16, got of course. It. And so that came out, and it was kind of like, I remember for myself, and I was with Colin at the time, because we had our event at DePaul that day.
Yep.
You know, it's kind of like, we should be happy, but we shouldn't be happy that this motherfucker who did something cool that was clearly, like, wrong, I would even say evil, you know, because, like, you want to defend yourself, that's cool, right? But, like, we can get into technicalities there. But we're content, right? And we're, like, we're happy that we're seeing justice.
Right. Whoa. And what is that? Whoa. Yeah, there's so many things, like, feelings with that verdict, that whole situation, right? Because, like, for one, Jason Van Dyke shoots Laquan McDaniels 16 times, right?
As he's walking away.
In 20.
With a knife in his hand.
Sure. Which is clearly wrong, right? In 2014. This is literally 4 years later. And we've been so much told that this mindset of, like, what justice looks like. If someone doing something wrong, they go to jail jail or prison for X amount of years. Mm-hmm. And so he gets found guilty, which, like, of the laws of the system, he should
have been.
But, like, does jail actually reform folks? Does it actually get people into entering society in a well way? Does it actually help the root cause of it, right? And, like, we operate and work with a lot of abolitionists. Like, only jail and prisons and police should exist. So it's like, and Austin worked on resisting CPD in multiple fashions and the whole situation. So it's like, okay, by the rules of the system, this is what should happen or more, and he should go to jail for a long time. But is that actual justice for Laquan? What do lack of resources, like you kind of mentioned before, and what situations, what environment, like, makes Laquan possible in the first place? Like, what does true justice look like, right? And is this part of it? And if it is, what does that say about us and what we actually, like, need and want? How does it actually, like, heal trauma in the first place? So, like, with me watching that verdict, it was like, I guess you would say happy, because this is what should happen with, again, like I said,
all of them.
With, yeah, sure, but it's like, but is this? Is this what we should be rooting for, right? And it's like, should he be killing young Black folks in the first place, or be able to do that in the first place?
And I think that was the same dichotomy that a lot of criminal defense attorneys found them in. It was, hey, well, I could use this as precedent for my client, which means precedent is basically when you have a decision in a case. Now, mostly all criminal cases are taken on a fact case-by-case basis. But you at least have a starting point, some kind of leverage or persuasion. Mm. We talk about persuasion to tell a judge, well, hey, well, this dude got found guilty by a jury for multiple things of this nature. And this thing, this guy had, you know, maybe these different factors that mitigated the fact that he killed someone and shot them 16 times, but he got this sentence. So my guy, who, you know, has more or less mitigation, but who didn't do as horrible as this guy, should get less. So, hey, you know, this is a case for us that we could say, hey, well, he got this. And the only difference between them is, well, my guy did less, and, you know, well, he might be black or minority or Latino, so what's going on with his sentence here? And it may be a different judge, but it was a way, for us, we were thinking like a way that you can kind of use persuasion and leverage to get the same results or better results for your own clients.
I didn't even think of that.
So that was the way criminal defense attorneys are thinking. But at the same time, it's like, oh, but that sucks for Laquan McDonald, because you know what everybody wanted. They wanted the hammer of justice to like come down. They wanted this dude to get life in prison. Why? Because it's trauma in the community. It's the community going to court, because you know a lot of family members show up to support their loved ones, and you know they're looked at critically. The family members, oh, how are you here? How could you possibly show up for this murderer, this rapist, or whoever? But they forget that this person came from a group of people, that they love him. They still love this person. They're here to support this person. It has to do with, I support you and that I give you that support. I don't condone what you do, but I'm here to support you. And everybody deserves that support, no matter kind of what they do. And if we're for criminal justice reform, well, this is a type of reform. This is a case we can use to say, well, hey, you gave it to this cop, so why can't it be used for everybody else? Mm-hmm. It's a way to show them to say, hey, you guys keep doing things status quo. We got a case for equal protection violation. You're violating the 14th Amendment of the Constitution because you're clearly now treating different people differently. So you have like clear evidence of it, because that was such a publicized case, and you can just take the statistics of like how they've been sentencing, which is how we got the JPEG situation going. You can just take the statistics, which you get statistics when you have people court watching and taking notes.
Hey,
bang.
But you can compile all that together to say, hey, well, these other dudes did the same thing or less, and they got this heavy sentence. So what's going on? The only difference between them, this was a former cop, and you know he's of whatever national origin or they want to say he was, you know, white or so. And then this guy over here did the same thing. He's black and, you know, look at the difference. Or he's, you know, Latino or whatever the case. So this is a way it was one side of the coin to say, hey, well, I could use this. But it was the other kind of side of the coin to say, hey, you know, he didn't get justice because, you know, the community is traumatized. They've always been going to court, seeing their loved ones, having the full hammer of justice slammed down on them, sitting in life behind bars, not enough people go to the juvenile court. I don't know if that's necessarily public. It should be, but not enough people go to juvenile court. And a lot of these juveniles were treated as adults until the Supreme Court said, hey, wait a minute. These are kids. You can't give a kid life sentence. Like, they just start living their life. And if we look at kids as innocent, then how are we saying they're innocent? But if you're a kid of, you know, certain demographics, because they start seeing that, then all of a sudden your life isn't so innocent. All of a sudden you're not so innocent. All of a sudden at this age, at an earlier age than other kids, you can be treated as culpable. You should have known better. So now I can treat you as an adult, and I can put you in the adult prison population, and whatever else happens to you happens.
Sure. And I think with that, it's like there's this whole, I don't know what to call it, but making young black boys men, like the Mike Brown situation. It's like, I feel like, you know, he felt for his life and he thought he was like being threatened. I think it has to do with like his size and seeing Mike Brown's 18-year-old young person as an adult, as a man. And I think that's a narrative you hear a lot, and it's very much like coded with other situations. Like Brock Turner, the kid who raped the young woman, he's like, oh, like, you know, he's, I want to ruin his life, and, you know, this will ruin his swimming career. And he's like, you know, just a kid. And it's
I
like,
remember
he's in college. He knew what he did. Like, I was, you know.
Right.
And so it's like,
and he's a kid,
well,
though.
And like you said, like you said, with like, well, I want to make this verse with laws and with narratives, right? Like, Jesus, you mentioned earlier as far as like how you know, narratives can be, you know, different with who we're talking about. And same with the laws. And it's interesting how those are conflated a lot of the times with how we use the narrative and the law together with how we sentence certain folks.
Right. Yeah.
This could be for both of you, but like, what is your guys' reaction to the Attorney General reviewing the sentencing of Laquan McDonald specifically? Or if you even have an opinion?
I mean, my opinion was just like, oh, man. So, like, there goes the precedent.
Damn.
Sorry. But really? Then, like, that was me thinking as a practitioner. Because, like I said, as a practitioner, you want the best result for your client. Why? Because in my idea, I'm fighting for somebody's life. Like, in one case, you know, the life is this other person. As tragically as it ended or whatever happened, you know, it ended in some kind of way, shape, or form. Or they were harmed. And I feel like if we agree that the punitive criminal justice system or putting them in jail doesn't reform them, and we want reformation or rehabilitation, then there has to be some alternative methods. So thinking outside the box and trying to craft some kind of reform, maybe they take some anger management classes, or they get some therapy, or they get the help that they actually never got because they had been traumatized. A lot of victims actually, you know, make other victims. They victimize other victims because they were a victim and they never got that help. So if we can stop the cycle, then to me, we actually reach the ultimate goal of tranquility or peace. So when the Attorney General was picking the case, I was like, oh, okay. Well, I mean, if they find it, they take it up to the Supreme Court, which they did, I heard, then we won't have any more precedent. But then on the other hand, I was like, well, if they're going to keep given the same sentence to, you know, other minority groups, because that I believe was still happening, that there was, you know, people who maybe did less as worse as him were getting these harsh sentences, then, well, he needs to get a harsh sentence too. And then until we get an overhaul of the system, well, kind of everybody just, the chips just fall as they may, because we had this system, I mean, for a very long time. So I think it actually needs an overhaul so that we can actually put into the law, you know, that, you know, what the new aim of our new system should be. If it's to be rehabilitation, well, all the punishments or all the reform needs to be crafted for that aim, basically. So I was just like, I felt both ways. Like, okay, well, you deserve it. But at the same time, I was like, oh, my clients.
One of the things that I really, like, you know, diving more into the case, then we have the three police officers who were a part of the cover-up.
Yeah.
Right, for Laquan McDonald. Yeah, go ahead.
The first thing that came up to my mind about that case, outside of the facts already, was that there was three other cops. And my thing is, like, you don't want to say, you know, police are organized,
gang?
I
can say police is an organized gang.
We don't need to,
I can say it is.
But they did an organized crime. Like, because they knew about it, and you would think, you know, they would enforce the RICO Act.
Mafia 2.0.
Right. And it's just unfortunate that they just got left, like, with no charge.
But for those that don't know, explain the RICO Act. What is that?
So the RICO Act is talked a lot about in like hip hop culture. It's the only reason I know about it.
You know about it because you're in a legal field now.
Yeah, and that's in the legal field.
You have to say shout out to Drake and Meek Mill. You know, right.
Shout out to Meek.
But yeah, the RICO Act is anybody organized, like a mob or a gang, and they, well, pretty much extortionate and do illegal things together, and pretty much, if one gets caught, they all get the RICO Act, meaning they all get pretty much charge for affiliation or
even
known. So. The Dark Knight has a good fantastical fictional view of Rico. It really does. It's really good.
Fans get them the moment they cross state lines. Then it's all game. They can't wait. Yeah.
So as soon as something crosses state lines,
it makes it a federal issue.
They're trying to make sure he doesn't get fucked up later. Yeah, I'm not like, trying to. Wait, what you're saying is. What you're saying is. All this shit. What do you mean? I'm not trying to. Rico R.I.C.
No, but it's a serious thing. And so, like, seeing these other police officers going through their trials and, like, and they're just like, you know, like, we're Gucci. Like, nothing. It's like, to me, like, it pisses me off.
I think it's a common thread between everything you guys are saying. Like, David posed questions to UT and Jesus about, like, how you feel about certain situations. And you all being in the field are, like, kind of torn. Like, the human part of me says, like, hey, this is messed up. But also, like, hey, I can use this for my client. Right? Yeah. But I think that for me, it's like I'm hearing all this and it's like the application of how it's used, how the narrative and the law are used with certain folks and not with other folks, right?
Correct.
So and how do we change our systemic inequality from the root of it is my question. It's like, how do we get to a point where whether we believe that jail should be abolished or not, how do we make sure everything's at least applied equally across the board? How do we get to equality? Then we get to equity. How do we get to equity? Right. Then we get to equality.
Yeah.
I don't, as long as we do have this kind of organized mob that you called for the police force, I mean, and then we have now have the new cop academy and plans for it to be built. Mm-hmm. Being more solid, because there was a big fight at the city council, I believe, for the funding, and people were pretty upset, but they kind of just railroading it through either way. So we had to take it to court in order to get it to be reopened to some kind of, for the community to be able to participate. They kind of closed the community off from the community. We sent people out there. It was pretty tragic how they just kind of railroaded that through and then tried to do so very privately at a public venue. Yeah. But I was outraged, going back to what he said about the wife. I felt, as a practitioner, like just thinking of having the two different sides, I felt, okay, I can deal with that. Like the guy himself who did it, I mean, he got some kind of justice. He was found guilty and it was acknowledged that what he did was a crime. But then these other guys getting off for what basically amounts to perjury and criminal conspiracy and covering this thing up. That really outraged me, to be honest, because we deal with it a lot with our clients and going back to the practitioner mind, we deal with it a lot with our clients because sometimes where you don't have any like video camera or any type of audio, all you have is this cop's word versus your client.
Right.
And so if your client has a background, now all of a sudden you're faced with, okay, I got this client with a background and a Chicago police officer. Yeah. So like, you're like, but if these cops had at least got, even if they got no jail time, if they at least were acknowledged as found guilty for perjuring, then their credibility is shot. Now you have a fighting chance in cases where they're saying, oh, your client did X, Y, and Z. Well, why should we believe you? Because you lied about this. So how should the judge or the jury rate your credibility as high, even for a police officer? In the end, they didn't even fire you. You're still a police officer. Yeah. So it kind of creates a snowball effect of showing how the system is a mockery. But when we don't get that, I feel like even that, like people felt like that was small. I felt that was big. The biggest thing you can do is get perjury against a cop. And then if you get proof of perjury, then you have now shot that cop's credibility. So even if the police force keeps that cop, he can't come into another courtroom with his head held high saying your client did X, Y, and Z. I'm gonna say, oh, the same as you said that other person did X, Y, Z. And what happened at that? You can control a courtroom at that circumstance.
It's gonna be hard for him to swear in.
I can see you in a courtroom and I see like Method Man rapping behind you like, you lying ass motherfucker, get up, grow up.
It's like, please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear? Oh, wait, please don't swear because if you perjured yourself again, you're out of here.
You're out of here, buddy.
As Colin mentioned, like, I think it's really interesting that like we're able, me and Colin have this way of talking about police and things like that. But you guys, on the other hand, like, y'all, it's not that you guys can't. Maybe you can't. But it's like you're also implicated into this system in a very unique fashion. So therefore, mm-hmm. y'all can't, like, you deal with more police officers than I do, realistically. Yeah. Like, I don't, yeah, if I deal with them, I'm hoping to God we're not dealing. Yeah. You know, so it's like, it's just different. Just
dealing with the system overall, I think that's.
And the way which you're doing it, right? Because, like, for sure, I could be caught up in, like, you know, got caught on a DUI or some dumb shit. Yeah, it's like, yo, all right, I'm experiencing the system. But I'm experiencing the system through this lens, right? Versus y'all, especially with the background that you guys have, and especially, like, seeing the spectrum of individuals that you're interacting with. It's like, it only works to your pro, but then how much, like, how far do you go before you get jaded? You know what I'm saying? And this is really interesting. And I think I might have mentioned this before, but, like, a while back, I was driving around. I Uber, like, when I'm bored or need money. So usually it's both. But there was this one gentleman who was like, yeah, no, I'm an attorney, blah, blah, blah. I do this, this, and this. And I, like, usually I'm juvenile detention, blah, blah, sort of mentality. He's like, but to be honest, man, because he's like, where are you from? I'm like, oh, I'm from, like, 26 in Costner. He's like, oh, man, like, well, you lucky you made it out and blah, blah, woo, woo. And I was just like, well, I mean, like, sure, I made it out. But it was like, you know, what does that do? He's like, well, most of the kids I deal with, you know, at first, you know, I was trying to help them out. But, like, at this point, I'm 18 years and I'm just jaded. And I'm like, then you're not doing your job. You get somebody, you're supposed to protect them, and you feel like they're immediately guilty. Like, what does that mean that you're doing? He was also a little bit drunk, so he got a little bit upset. I ended up dropping off.
Probably more honest than normal, though. I mean, like, right now, for all of us.
No, but it's like, it's that was only one individual who I interacted with for maybe 20 minutes tops. And he's being this honest with me and being like, yeah, you know, like, you're this brown boy. If I would have seen you, like, I'm going to assume you're guilty. And so what I would do is I get you to take a plea bargain, because that's what he was telling me. He's like, most of these kids, I just tell them to take pleas.
Right.
And I'm like, but if they're not guilty, he's like, yeah, but usually they are. Yeah. But then if your brain is telling you without wanting to look at anything else, and of course, like, you're dealing with these kids, you don't even know their names anymore at this point. It's like, you don't give a fuck. Right. If you don't give a fuck, then why are you doing your job? That's it. I didn't even think about commission.
Yeah, that's the doc off. That's the doc off. Your problems are somebody's benefit. That's the mockery right there. That's
pretty. I think Jesus can talk about that a lot, about attorneys that are jaded. My thing is, how I keep doing it is, for one, I gotta find opportunities to laugh. And I find opportunities.
In court?
Sometimes. Sometimes
in court. We got motherfuckers time. As ugly as time. Right.
So we see your toupee. Are you going to fix your toupee before you give us a sentence?
Yeah. Like, sometimes you just have to find. Yeah, you have to find humor, your laughter and something find
serious.
Humor,
something. Sometimes it's too serious. It's scary. It's like.
It is.
How can
it
we
is.
Be so serious on
this? It is. So I mean, it's weird. Maybe attorneys do have weird senses of humor, but you have to develop some type of defense mechanism because it will swallow you whole. And for the most part, I really appreciate, you know, having different characters around. I mean, we're all human. Having different characters around that can make you laugh, different opportunities to look at a situation kind of comically. Like, is this really reality? Is this really happening? Did this dude really do this? And you have to, you know, your clients can be really comical, and comedians as well. But I would say also, like, just exposures to different communities. A lot of people take things that they don't understand about different cultures, different communities, and they use prejudice against it. They dislike it, they hate it, or they try to find some ways, like, oh, I don't understand it, so I don't like it. But I try to take, you know, exposure to different communities and say, well, those things that people find stereotypical, they're not necessarily, like, a reason to not like somebody. Like, let's laugh about it. Like, you laugh about stuff for me, I laugh about stuff for you. Like, laughter just brings no people feelings. Together, no right?
No laughter you get is, life in jail, but no hard feelings.
That's how they see it.
And now you bridge the gap. And now you've made a lasting memory, a lasting friendship. Yeah. And now you've made an alliance.
Right.
So that's what it's all about, forming alliances, forming relationships, and exposing people, exposing yourself. You have to challenge yourself before you even can challenge someone else.
World, right. Even.
So one of the last points I want to make is, like, so what have you guys seen, you know, in your field as the biggest changes? And I know you've been in there not as long. Tia, maybe you've been there a little bit longer, but, like, what are some of the largest changes that you have seen within your practices, and like, really, where is it that you see things going?
Well, I could say what I see is that, first and foremost, if the people do the court watches, then I feel like that'll change into facts, because a lot of people are confused about the facts. And if you don't have the facts, a lot of people, it's just human nature. It's unfortunate, but if you can't see it with your own eyes, it don't exist. Yeah, basically, yeah. People operate kind of off that. So if you see it with your own eyes, you can say, "This is my fact. This is my story." It becomes their story, but their story is somebody else's story. So I feel like if this call to action is successful, people can get out and go court watch, and then we'll have numbers, we'll have statistics out there, because we'll have stories, whether they come in the form of a blog, a podcast, or come in the form of any other kind of media outlet, YouTube video. But we start having statistics that we can start watching these videos. I mean, a lot of us do it on a daily basis, just kind of, you know, whether you actually engage in it or not, they hit the highlight points and they say this statistic, that statistic, I went there this many times, and we can start compiling data, because that's what it seems like. The numbers, it's a numbers game. That seems to get across to people. When you start talking numbers, this many thousands of people did this, or this certain judge did this for this many hundreds of people on this day, on a daily basis, or all the days that I went. When you start talking numbers to people, it starts to kind of transform their understanding. And then they're like, "Well, I don't believe you. I go see it for myself." So you also gauge interest. Even if you don't get your numbers across, people, you know, you can do catch line phrases. "Hey, look at this, 560 defendants sentenced to life in prison." And now they're like, "Oh no, I'm going to court right now because I don't believe that." Like, or they believe you, like, "Oh no, I gotta see this. Like, oh my god, like, is this really happening? Is this America? Like, I know." So you like get a reaction out of people. So I feel like the court watches would be the next step.
Yeah, and when we say court watches, we really are not targeting people that are working, because we understand, you know, a 9 to 5 or you know, 6 in the morning to like 5. But what we really want to target are our students. Because there's some people that do have free time. They do, you know, sometimes they're, you know, for, you know, they get the spring break, the winter break, and all that comes to play, because what you do with your time, you know, you live in a community, you should be aware of what's going on in community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because you're the next generation. So at the end of the day, it's just a lot, like Tia says, it's a numbers game. We have a lot of, we have a lot of people in our community. You can't sleep on it.
But your area is what courthouse feeds into maybe what courthouse?
I mean, the only courthouse around my neighborhood is the one at the police station on Central and Grand. Yeah, Branch. What was that, 23?
But a couple of people might feed it on the Skokie courthouse.
Or Skokie.
Yeah. There's also Rolling Meadows in Cook County. There's Markham, the Daily Center. Yeah. There is Bridgeview. And there is, so I did the first Daily Center, the second is Skokie. The third is Rolling Meadows. The fourth is Maywood Courthouse. The fifth is Bridgeview. And the sixth is Markham. So if you can get to one of those courthouses.
Just to watch and see how somebody's life is being either it's they're getting a sentence or it could be something minor, like a traffic matter. But even little mistakes like that, they cost money. You know, your mistake or whatever you did, your infraction costs money.
And write down those numbers, because court fees and costs, $1,700 and $2.14. Write down everybody's, how much are these courts getting, but yet they keep telling us they broke.
They ain't got no money.
But
they still trying to get $214 off of me for like 9 months. Right. I go to court, the traffic court.
I got it.
And they're like, "Okay, Mr. Moran, you have $214. How much you be paying?" I'm like, "I got shit.
On a payment plan." How about getting a payment plan?
Well, I mean, because they tell you, like, you put $25 every time.
Right, that's what they hit you with.
But they want their money. All of it.
I just been signing to go back to court.
Right.
I'm like, when's the next time I come back? I go back February 27th. So, like, I'll show up.
They will hold you hostage in your life for some money.
And if I don't show up, they cancel my license.
Yeah. And
then they can take my car. Yeah. Oh, man.
Get caught driving.
Bullshit.
And you get a warrant. Let's not forget the warrants that you have to go back to court and quash. Your case is suspended, and now you got an active warrant.
Yeah.
And people have been picked up on like 10-year-old warrants. And when they get you, they get you. Because now you have to wait for them to bound your case over to a judge in order to adjudicate whether or not you should get a bail or not or so. Yeah. And before we did the bail reform with the Chicago Mini Bond Fund, people were getting bonds that were outrageous. They couldn't afford them. Right. They didn't care whether you can afford them. They cared like, oh, your flight risk, you're not getting out at all. So people were spending. I had a client that spent Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. And New Year's, and they had technically voluntarily turned themselves in on a warrant that wasn't active yet, but it was active somehow when they showed up at the station.
So that's just for that. But we actually are working with Jesse Jackson, and we are actually doing this other immigration.
So we're strategizing ways of which how political leaders in the community can support. So mainly, aside from criminal defense, I do immigration. It's probably like the largest force of my practice now because of all the issues with the new administration. So as far as immigration is concerned, it's kind of like a catch-22. A lot of people don't know this. It's a catch-22. You get caught up for not having papers, but they take about 5 years to give you papers. And not only 5 years, 5 years and thousands of dollars later, and you still don't have papers because, well, they say, oh, well, we're not giving you papers until you give us this paper. So you get them more paper, and it's just an administrative, bureaucratic.
It's a cyclical thing. It's
cyclical mess. People have been waiting. I have some clients who come to me. They've been waiting 10, 20 years for some paper that they put in when there was even a different when the organization, the administration was named INS and now it's USCIS, and somehow the paperwork gets just lost in the middle, and these people have been waiting 10, 20 years to adjust their status and become a resident. So it's just kind of catch 22, like, oh, we're going to catch you and put you in jail because you ain't got your green card. But you're like, I ain't got my green card because you ain't adjudicate my case. And then once you get in court, they're like, oh, but now the court has to adjudicate your case. So now we're not going to adjudicate your case at all. But it's like, oh, but now you have a higher standard in court to be able to prove that your case should be adjudicated. So now you have no relief. Get out of this country. You can sign voluntarily or we can deport you forcefully.
Right.
Take your pick.
And even those statistics, yeah, we need to bring a couple court watches there because, you know, we do want to see how many people do get, because that's important. At the end of the day, that's important because, well, where is this money going to? And you know, because
it's thousands of dollars it's in ridiculous. Immigration.
The bail.
The government require, like, the bail, there's no 10%. If the government says you have to post 10,000, you need to come up with every last dollar. Every last dollar. So if you don't come up with 10,000, you're not getting out. That's it.
And you know, it's very to the family because that's somebody's life. At the end of the day, you cannot put like money
price on somebody's
life. And pretty much that they come up with the money somehow they make it happen. Like, hey, you know, post a bond and they pay it. But just the fact that they paid it is just like, okay, so what's the next move?
So I really
and
see
that's just one life.
Yeah,
I really see everything merging so much that because. To be honest, like he read the phrase from the Jewish author.
He's not Jewish.
Or is he a poet?
He's not Jewish.
Poet of some sort.
He's a poet of some sort, right. So I really feel that once we get the bare minimum standards for immigrants, then we have ensured the protections for Americans. Because you have to think about it, like he said, and then they came for them, and I said nothing. If we allow the bare minimum protections to erase or be eradicated for them, like, this is the Department of Homeland Security. This is the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. They're about securing the homeland. These agents are operating in our borders.
That's a new department after 9/11, which is really
correct.
Coded to like,
but they're after 9/11, and to me, I'm naturally suspicious.
What Homeland Security actually does?
Any organization that comes after 9/11? Why? Because I know we've already gave away so many of our civil liberties that is actually scary. So think about it. The Department of Homeland Security has such broad authority. Who's to stop them from grabbing U.S. citizens and saying, where your papers at? Where your birth certificate? Because there's stories right now of U.S. citizens suing the government, losing because they were grabbed. One man, 2 years he spent in ICE custody trying to prove he was a U.S. citizen.
That's ridiculous.
I'm going to get my birth certificate back home.
But the fact that we're in our homeland
right.
as American citizens and we're scared, we're starting to get scared. Like, wait a minute. Do I got my passport? Do I got something to show? Like, I'm authorized to be here because, they might say I'm Haitian. They might say, you know, he ain't American.
You Peruvian as fuck.
Yeah, right. Or he's Mexican. Like, you got to go back to Mexico.
Talking perfect English.
I got to go back to Africa or Haiti or wherever they say I'm from. Like, what's to prevent that?
Yeah. What? Us,
right? Exactly. Doing like, it. We have Doing to. It. Like, this is a life or death. This is a life situation. Like, can you imagine? Some people spend 2 to 5 years, they spend the average in ICE custody because, you know, the family members couldn't come with either the papers fast or they say, oh, you're lying. We don't believe you. This is not your paperwork. So, like, it's a serious situation. And then there was a American citizen who was, what was she, like, Mexican-American or so? But she was a U.S. citizen. And they brought out her paperwork, and the woman still, so she did a civil rights suit against the government. But, like, how many more of these are going to have to happen before people see that when you get agents, when you allow them to just bust up in immigrants, quote-unquote immigrants' home, saying, hey, we got a detainer here. It's not even a court judicially signed warrant. Yeah. It's a sign from an immigration officer saying, hey, you can detain this person right. because this is the person we're looking for. He's an immigrant. He has no rights. Then how soon are they going to be using that detainer against U.S. citizens or busting up in U.S. citizens' homes?
Yeah. I mean, they do that already and shoot you in your fucking apartment.
But we get to hold them accountable. But once we relax the standards for immigrants, we're relaxing the standards for ourselves. Because then they're going to say, oh, well, now if you say something, I'm going to charge you with aiding and abetting. We love that one. We're going to charge you with aiding this person who you knew was illegal because that's a crime. So now you're facing federal charges, and this person's facing immigration charges.
Yeah. Kind of like the RICO Act. It's got the
exactly. Like, oh, you're affiliated. Oh, you knew this person was illegal, and you let them in your house. Now all of a sudden, like, it just has a chain effect. And what family member do you know is going to, like, rat out? You know, what family member is going to just say, hey, here's my father. Damn, you can Fredo. Take my father and detain him indefinitely.
Yo, if he was a piece of shit, then maybe. No, but it's fair. And I think, like, this is a conversation, as a lot of the conversations that we have at Browntown. You know, they can just keep going, you know,
like
y'all are super cool. I'm really happy that we were able to get you guys in here. There's definitely going to be a part two, part three, part four. We'll keep it where it's going. But we appreciate you guys coming out here, sharing some of the insight with you guys. Cause you know, it could also be difficult. You know, not everyone can go up, you know, with their backgrounds and being able to go up to a mic, be able to go a stage of people and be able to just be like real. Right. And that's what we try to do. And y'all were real with it. And we really appreciate that. Just so you guys know. And as always, from Bourbon and Browntown, stay black, stay brown, stay queer.
Stay tuned, stay turnt.
All right, we out here. We see you next time.
Thank you.
And now it's winter in America.
For more information on episode guests, related media, and topics, check out the episode notes. Follow us on social media at SoapboxPO and or visit SoapboxPO.com/podcast.